Lecture 28, Mahatma Gandhi.
Few people in all of human history are as famous, admired, and imitated as is Mohandas Mahatma Gandhi. Within India, most people consider him the father of the nation. So today, every Indian currency note of every denomination bears his portrait. His birth date is a national holiday, and the anniversary of his assassination is still marked by a 2-minute national moment of silence. Internationally, Gandhi's achievements and face are almost universally recognized. They've been used to sell a range of products, from T-shirts to Apple computers. Every time a protester makes a public fast or a sit-in against a war or a political or a social injustice, this evokes Mahatma Gandhi and his moral authority. An internet search of his name produces over 13 million hits. Good libraries are filled with dozens of books about him, and authors publish more every year. But many writers and thinkers disagree about who Gandhi was, what he stood for, and how he would have judged the morality of any of today's pressing issues. Famous and influential, revered and imitated, Mohandas Gandhi was also a complex man who changed over his lifetime in response to his time and place, to the changing world in which he lived. In this lecture, we'll consider Mohandas Gandhi as he lived in four distinct worlds, each during a different period of his life. First, we'll explore Gandhi's youth spent in India under British colonial rule. Here, we'll see that to get ahead under British rule and its Anglicization policies, one had to look like they did, to speak, eat, and dress like the British. Next, we'll follow Gandhi to London, where he went to train as a lawyer and also to study English manners. We'll see that during his years in this second world of Britain, he gained valuable insights about the lives of British men and women, and in the process, also learned much about his heritage and himself. Then we'll travel with Gandhi to South Africa, his third world, where he remained for over 20 years. He gained success as a lawyer and also as a community organizer. But we'll also see that this was a traumatic period when the cruel legal system of racial segregation, later called apartheid, was just beginning. Finally, we'll follow Gandhi back to India. This was a very different world from what he had left decades earlier. Here, we will see how he soon took leadership over the main nationalist movement for independence, and how he became a champion for social reform. But Gandhi faced great challenges as he worked to build a single nation and a just society out of India's diversity. As we look at each of these four worlds, we're greatly aided by his own writings. Much of his life was devoted to journalism and to publicizing his political and social causes. He started and ran newspapers for much of his life, often writing most of the articles himself. He also wrote his exceptionally candid autobiography, The Story of My Experiments with Truth. Much of what he wrote was in his native language, Gujarati. But the reverential devotion of his translators into English often cover up the humor and wit of his original words. After his death, his dedicated followers compiled the collected works of Mahatma Gandhi, from his many articles, pamphlets, and even scraps of paper and bits of envelope on which he scribbled notes. These total 90 printed volumes. Many people recorded their overwhelming experience of having met him, especially after he became famous. Prominent leaders, including Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela, wrote about how important Gandhi's ideas and actions had been for them. So we also have a vast array of source material that reveals how Gandhi shifted significantly in each phase of his long and tempestuous life, in each of his four worlds. Let's start with the world of colonial India in which he was born and spent his youth. For three generations, Gandhi's male ancestors had served as prime ministers of small coastal kingdoms in the western Indian region of Gujarat. He himself was born in 1869 in the small kingdom of Porbandar. Although the kingdom's entire population was only about 70,000 people, the capital town was a bustling commercial port on the Arabian Sea. There, people of many different cultures and origins lived and interacted. Gandhi's own father was the chief minister of this kingdom. But Gandhi's family were not warriors. Traditionally, his family had been greengrocers, which is what the name Gandhi means. They were hereditarily part of the mercantile community, which is the third of the Hindu Varnas, ranked below Brahmin priests and below warriors. But his community ranked above the large majority of the population of lower caste workers called Shudras, and below them, people who used to be known as outcasts or untouchables. Gandhi would devote much of his life to working to aid those lower caste people. Like many others within their mercantile community, Gandhi's family valued nonviolence, and they were strict vegetarians. But they lived as conquered and colonized subjects under the British Raj, where different values prevailed. When Gandhi was born, the British had already seized many kingdoms of India, starting over a century earlier. But about one-third of India was not directly under British rule. Rather, these many scattered kingdoms were still ruled by one of the more than 600 remaining Indian rulers, often called Rajas or Maharajas, like the Maharaja of Porbandar, whom Gandhi's father served. However, all these many kings were really under the power of the British and had to submit to British orders. Porbandar itself had only come under British indirect rule just before the birth of Gandhi's father. By the time Gandhi himself was growing up, his family had seen clearly that to hold on to their political position, an English-style education was now vital. The British conquered India mainly by force, but they ruled over Indians in large measure by convincing them of British racial and cultural superiority. In particular, Hindus like Gandhi's family had felt themselves inferior, not only to the white Christian British, but also to the Muslim kings who had ruled much of India for hundreds of years before the British. One of Gandhi's childhood friends was the son of the Muslim police chief of Porbandar. Since Muslims, like the British, are mostly meat eaters, this friend convinced young Gandhi to experiment with eating cooked goat flesh in order to make him as strong as he believed meat-eating Britons and meat-eating Muslims were. But Gandhi soon found that eating meat not only violated his family's religious values, it also revolted his own stomach. He had nightmares about a live goat bleeding inside of him, so he stopped that failed experiment. Gandhi continued to believe for years, however, that an English education and mastery of English laws and manners would empower him and advance his family. Gandhi had followed his family's custom and had his engagement arranged by his parents to a woman he did not know when they were both only 7 years old. They married when he was 13. They had their first son when they were only 16. Although that son died at birth, they soon had two other sons. But Gandhi determined to leave them all behind in order to improve himself. At age 18, he traveled to London to study law and become an Anglicized gentleman, and also to find himself. In going to Britain, he became part of a larger movement of people from Britain's colonies to its imperial capital. Indeed, Indian men and women of all classes had already been going to Britain for three centuries, as we've discussed in a previous lecture. During Gandhi's 3 years in Britain, he had three major projects. First, he enrolled to become a qualified barrister, the British term for the highest status lawyers who could appear before a judge in court. He and his family agreed that achieving such status, although expensive, would ensure his lucrative career after his return to India. Second, Gandhi worked to become as Anglicized as he could. This, he and his family believed, would enable him to interact socially with the British who ruled India. Third, he wanted to explore his own identity and place in both his Indian heritage and in the world of London. In each project, Gandhi learned and changed much while in London through his daily interactions with British men and women. At that time in Britain, to qualify as a barrister, a young man had to pay for and attend 72 meals in one of the inns of court over a 3-year period. Gandhi enrolled in one of these inns called the Inner Temple. The original purpose of this requirement was for students of the law to dine with established barristers and learn from them about the law and about table manners. But over the centuries, this original purpose had been lost. Barristers ate separately at the raised head table, while students ate lower down in the room. As it turned out, Gandhi was very popular, not for his conversation, but because he did not drink the wine or eat the meat that he had paid for. So his table mates could take his share as well as their own. As the second requirement to qualify as a barrister, students had to take two simple examinations in the law. But the questions on these exams were largely known in advance, and almost everyone passed on the first try. In practice, students of the law were supposed to pay a fee to apprentice with a working barrister and learn the profession on the job. This Gandhi did not do. Instead, he spent his time and limited funds trying to become an English-style gentleman. He paid for lessons in ballroom dancing, violin, and French, but later admitted that he had mastered none of these. He studied the latest fashions, and he had clothes tailored to match. Another Indian student met and described him as, quote, wearing a high silk hat burnished bright, a high collar stiff and starched, a rather flashy tie displaying almost all the colors of the rainbow, under which there was a fine striped silk shirt. He wore as his outer clothing a morning coat, a double-breasted vest, and dark striped trousers to match, and not only leather boots, but spats over them. He carried leather gloves and a silver-mounted stick. Close to him. In order to meet British women, Gandhi concealed his marriage and sons back in India. But he described his several dates with British women as failures, since he always lost his nerve. Finally, he revealed that he was married as a way to get out of one of those relationships. But Gandhi was more successful in finding himself through his Hindu traditions. Since many Britons associated vegetarianism with Hindus, the vegetarian movement in London gave him special respect. He gave his first public speech to them. He also studied many of the major Hindu religious texts for the first time while in London. So he found his self-assurance growing in this regard, even as the rest of his time in London was less successful. He left London as soon as he could to begin his career as a barrister back in India. When Gandhi returned to his family at age 21, he found that he actually knew little about how to practice law. The first and only time he found a client and tried to represent her in court, he could only stammer and rushed out in disgrace. Then, when he approached British officials, even men he had known in England, they rudely rejected him as a presumptuous Indian. Finding no place for himself in India after his very expensive education in London, Gandhi left and did not return there to live for more than 20 years. Moving to South Africa at age 24, Gandhi entered his third world. There, he was hired to represent an Indian merchant who was suing a relative who owed him money. This was a small case, hardly worthy of a qualified barrister, but Gandhi accepted it anyway. At that time, there were four separate governments in South Africa. In the interior were the two countries of Transvaal and the Orange Free State. Both were settled and ruled by white Afrikaners, also known as Boers, meaning farmer in Afrikaans. In the southwest was the British-ruled Cape Colony, and on the eastern coast, along the Indian Ocean, was the British-ruled colony of Natal, with Durban as its capital. Natal had many sugar plantations, which required many manual laborers to do the dangerous and difficult work of cutting and processing the cane. After the slave trade ended, plantations began to import Indian indentured laborers. As you'll recall from the last lecture, indentured laborers signed a 5-year contract for labor. By the time Gandhi arrived, there were about 40,000 Indians in Natal, counting both those under indenture and those who were free laborers. This was about the same as the number of whites, counting both British and Afrikaners. The number of black Africans who lived in their homeland of Natal was about 10 times as many as either whites or Indians. While in South Africa, Gandhi suffered worse disrespect and abuses from whites than he had in India. This made clear to him that despite his law degree and growing prosperity, he was seen by most whites in all the colonies as racially inferior. This also gave Gandhi a sense of solidarity with the vast majority of Indians in Natal who were indentured or free, but working class. When Gandhi first went to South Africa, the legal system of racial segregation and inequality was just beginning. This later became the apartheid system. There were many incidents of whites abusing non-whites, but few official laws had yet been passed by the all-white colonial government. Then, to keep Indians from becoming free, the government doubled the length of the indenture to 10 years. The government levied a special tax on all Indians, which was impossible for most working-class Indians to pay. Gandhi mobilized peaceful but forceful protests using his growing experience as a public speaker. These protests got the government to reduce this tax by almost 90%, and it was eventually repealed. Gandhi was preparing to return home to India when he read about another race law that took away the right to vote, even for rich non-whites. New pass laws required non-white people to live in certain designated areas of towns and cities, and to have a pass book signed by a white man before they could leave those areas. Gandhi stayed on in South Africa for over 20 years in order to oppose each of these new early apartheid laws. He devoted himself to campaigns of letter and petition writing, to writing newspaper articles and even starting newspapers, and to fighting each law in court. He also did extensive community organizing to help all Indians work together, both indentured and free. Over time, Gandhi brought almost all the Indians into an organization that he formed called the Natal Indian Congress. A few sympathetic whites also supported him. Gradually, Gandhi developed his most famous practice of nonviolent non-cooperation with injustice. This is sometimes called passive resistance, although Gandhi eventually rejected that term as not active enough. Because this concept was so new, Gandhi held a contest to invent a name for it. The term satyagraha won. Satya means truth in the largest sense, and agraha comes from the same word root as grasp. So satyagraha literally means grasp truth, never submit to untruth or injustice. Using satyagraha, Gandhi opposed each apartheid law by deliberately breaking it. He led nonviolent marches and sit-ins. He demanded that the British colonial government either repeal the law or punish him since he refused to obey it. But Gandhi and his arrested followers filled up the jails, so they had to be let out to make room for more protesters being arrested. Gandhi did not win many of these struggles, but he managed to force the British colonial government to modify some of these laws for the Indian community. One issue that arose from Gandhi's career in South Africa was the contrast between his dedicated commitment to the Indian community and his limited involvement with a much larger community of black Africans living around them. Gandhi rallied Indians using ideas and symbols from Indian traditions, especially from his own Hinduism. But these meant nothing in black African cultures. The mother tongue spoken by Gandhi and other Indians were completely different from the languages of black Africans. Plus, the racial segregation laws reinforced the separation between Indians and black Africans, especially since Gandhi won some minor rights for Indians that black Africans did not receive. So while Gandhi's Natal Indian Congress inspired the later African National Congress, and while some Indians joined the ANC, tensions have continued in South Africa between Indians who remain there and the much larger majority of black Africans. Another issue contributing to our understanding of Gandhi was his relationship to his wife and four surviving sons. How should any leader who's totally committed to his community and to all the people within it equally, treat his own wife and children? Gandhi's decision was to reject many of the personal demands on him from his family. This led to some strains in his relationship with his wife and each son. For example, he insisted that all jewelry given to her by supporters be used only for the movement. He denied his sons the advanced anglicized education that he had received and then devalued as immoral. It's not easy to be the family of such a dedicated leader. During his years in South Africa, Gandhi gained self-confidence and extensive experience in community organizing and politics. He also began to be known in India as a leader who was standing up to the British and showing some positive results. Finally, at age 46, Gandhi decided to return home to India, where he felt he could do more to help his people. There, he encountered a very different world from the one he had left as a youth. While there were few other Indian leaders of his stature in South Africa, in India, there were already various anti-colonial movements. The Indian National Congress was the most prominent Indian political movement when Gandhi returned. Remember, this movement had begun 30 years earlier as a lobbying group by elite Indian men, mostly lawyers. Many of them had trained in Britain before, during, and after Gandhi had been there. This organization actually inspired Gandhi's naming of his Natal Indian Congress. But the Indian National Congress mainly represented the interests of its elite male members and had not yet developed very effective goals or methods or accomplished much. Many older leaders wanted to gain rights and benefits for themselves, but not by openly confronting the British. Some of the younger leaders wanted to push harder against the British. After Gandhi returned to India, he quickly rose to the leadership of this younger and more active generation in the Indian National Congress. Significantly, Gandhi broadened the support base for the Indian National Congress. Most leaders before him had not reached out to the rural population, which contained the vast majority of Indians. Just 2 years after he returned to India, Gandhi went to a remote region of North India called Champaran to support farmers of indigo in their strike against the British plantation owners. The farmers had taken loans, but then the price of indigo had fallen. German-invented chemicals could produce blue dye much less expensively, so the Indian farmers could not repay the loans. Gandhi personally toured the region and encouraged the Indian farmers to hold out against the demands of the British owners. When he refused to back down and was arrested, Gandhi used his own trial to bring attention to the farmers' plight. Intelligently, he used the police agents who were following him and recording evidence against him by making them witnesses to prove what they had seen about abuses by the British owners. He then negotiated a compromise that both Indian farmers and British owners could accept. This non-violent campaign convinced many rural Indians that Gandhi was the leader they should follow. Later the same year, Gandhi went to Ahmedabad, the capital of his home province of Gujarat, to support Indian textile workers in their strike. British taxes had suppressed the once thriving Indian cloth weaving industry. Instead, almost all Indians bought British manufactured cloth, often made from Indian raw cotton that had been shipped to Britain and woven there. Only a very few Indian cloth factories existed, and this strike was by Indian workers against Indian factory owners. When the plague had hit the city, the factory owners had raised wages to keep workers on the job. After the plague subsided, the owners wanted to lower wages to their former level. So the workers went on strike. Gandhi went to support the workers who were running low on money and on hope. He told the workers that to end the strike without success would be an injustice, so he vowed to fast until death if they did so. This was the first of his many public fasts. Impressed by Gandhi's commitment to take suffering upon himself rather than accept injustice, both sides compromised. Out of this arose one of the first Indian labor unions, which is still strong today. This nonviolent campaign convinced many workers that Gandhi was the leader they should follow. Even as Gandhi worked to mobilize all Indians into a single nation, he faced much dissent. Several militant groups had been trying to drive out the British using assassinations, bombings of railways, and other acts of violence. Throughout his career in India, Gandhi struggled to convince these militants that violence would make the Indians as immoral as were the British. So when the first national strike he'd organized was gaining momentum, some of his supporters used violence by burning down a police station with the Indian policeman inside. Rather than accept this violence, Gandhi called off the entire national strike, since he believed Indians were not yet morally ready for independence because they were not yet totally nonviolent. During his career in India, Gandhi proved particularly astute in evoking powerful symbols, especially ones he shared with a vast majority of the population who were also Hindu. His most popular title, Mahatma, literally means great soul. This was given by popular acclaim to Gandhi and also to many other holy men in the Hindu tradition. His core concept of nonviolence and his powerful tactic of the public fast both came out of the high Hindu tradition. But the symbols and ideas he used to mobilize the majority of the population failed to attract sizable minorities. About 20% of India's population were men and women traditionally classed as untouchables or outcasts. These people lived in small hamlets scattered everywhere in India, doing the necessary but dirty work of sanitation and leatherworking and other services to the village community. Gandhi tried to lift these people out of their degraded status, renaming their community Harijans, literally the beloved of God Vishnu. But some leaders of this community regarded Gandhi as an outsider who was trying to speak for them. One of Gandhi's most controversial public fasts was against separate electoral constituencies demanded by and for these former untouchables. Gandhi felt that they could rise up only if they were accepted and integrated into the majority population. In the face of Gandhi's fast, these ex-untouchables had to back down from their demand, but many saw Gandhi as a high-caste Hindu oppressor. Another minority that increasingly rejected Gandhi's leadership was the quarter of the Indian population that was Muslim. The Muslim League was a political party founded to represent separate Muslim interests. Under British colonial rule, there were separate civil law codes for Muslims and Hindus. In the limited voting rights that a small percentage of the Indian population were beginning to achieve, the British established separate electoral constituencies for Muslims. In these races, only Muslim candidates could run for office and only Muslims could vote. These British laws intensified the distinctions and tensions between Muslim Indians and Hindu Indians. One of Gandhi's greatest frustrations was his inability to attract most Muslims to his movement. The split between the Indian National Congress and the Muslim League ultimately led to the partition of colonial India into the separate independent nations of the Secular Republic of India and the Islamic Republic of Pakistan in 1947. However, Gandhi refused to accept any political office. Rather, he worked until the end of his life building peace between these two religious communities, and then these two nations. Indeed, it was a Hindu nationalist who assassinated Gandhi for being too sympathetic of Muslims, just 1 year after independence. Over the 7 decades since his death, many people and movements have tried to follow the principles and tactics of Gandhi. Some only pay him lip service, but others have sincerely tried to apply his ideas to current issues. But other Indian leaders also charted their own different vision for the new nation. In the next lecture, we'll consider those alternatives to Gandhi.